A lot of young people hear about AI taking over the world. Should we be worried or excited about our future with AI, and what might it be like for us in 5 or 10 years?
You should not be worried, but you should be excited. Perhaps I thought AI might help to the big challenges of humanity, which might be climate change, which might be mobility, which might be health, I think on cancer, which might be energy. Our energy systems are super complicated. Also our cities. This is all systems which are super complex. Like the human cell, it's not understood. Cancer is not healed right now. And energy with renewable energy, with wind, with hydro energy, with solar energy, and also with the customers feeding back energy as private customers. And if you buy some power from neighboring countries, stuff like this, it's super complicated. You have to predict, the weather, you have to predict the behavior, you have to predict the producers. And these are super complex systems. And I think the only chance to handle these complex systems, it might be health, energy, traffic, is using AI. As we use the calculator, if we multiply big numbers, we don't do it ourselves anymore. We use machines, we use a calculator. If you want to understand complex systems, we should use AI. We should get help by these intelligent systems, which can perhaps understand or simulate or modulate these complex systems where many things are interacting with each other. And therefore, back to your question, now you should be excited. AI is a chance for a future. And if you only think about climate change, only with AI we will get this under control.
And what can it do with this data, that this complex data that humans might not be able to do, for example, with climate change? How can it help us solve it? And why would it be a benefit to us rather than just having human brains trying to solve climate change?
I think everybody thinks it's good to save the world, to save our environment, stop the climate change if it's too hot, if no plants anymore are growing. It's not good for us because as they produce our air, they produce our food. We have somehow understand it. And we humans make decisions how to countermand the stuff which already, the damage which is already done, but we have to understand it. Many things are not understood. I can give you an example. Here at my institute, we have a team working in hydrology. What they are doing is they predict how much water is in the river, different rivers. And they predicted they have weather data, but they have also data about the vegetation of the river, versus there's snow or whatever. And now, for many years, for 30 years, they were experts, and they have expert models how to simulate how much water is in the soil, how much water is underground in these basins, how much water is in the gletschers, is in the snow, and the snow is melting. And they have very complicated models. And then they use something which is called LSTM, standing for long short-term memory. Probably later we come to this topic. And it turned out it's working much better than all the models this hydrologist had for 30 years. And it's so good that nowadays his AI models, his LSTM models, are used by the US government, by the Canadian government, by the Israeli government to predict floodings, to warn their citizens. But it's also used by Google. Google has an app. If you're on travel, if you're abroad, you want to see, is your home in danger? Do you have something that says it's flooding warnings? And also this app was based on these AI models. Particularly our models. But now you can use these models because they are so good. What would happen if the temperature goes up 1 degree, goes up 2 degrees in a certain region? Perhaps all snow is gone. The vegetation changes. Now you can play some scenarios because you have so good models and can play in the future. What would happen if we don't do something against the increase of the temperature? This is climate change models. This is a small hydrological model, but AI helped us to understand what's going on.
So does it create more, help create more accurate predictions of what might happen if their variable changes.
Exactly. Especially if you have different weather conditions and stuff like this. And here's the idea is you have so much data across the world from different rivers in US, in Africa, in Europe, and learning from all this data over many years, decades, gives you more insight in what happens, what is the underground basins. Nobody has had explored it. Nobody understands what is the dynamics, if it's full of water, whatever. But if you learn from many data, if you have such a lot of data around the world from many rivers, from many different weather conditions, in Spain, it's in Sweden, it's colder, stuff like this. You learn a lot about water in the river, depending on the weather, depending on also the sun, which is melting as snow, and it's data-driven. And that's what gives us AI. If you have enough data, you can understand or modulate, simulate complex systems, which is just much too complicated for us humans to understand or to predict what's happening.
So we're collecting the data and then putting it into AI. Will there be a time where AI can record and collect its own data and create its own data? Is that already happening, or is it that still down to human input?
That's not a good idea. In theory, yes. We have right now, you are aware of these large language models like ChatGPT is an example. And so we are trained by grabbing also data from the internet, all books which are electronically available, all publications, which normally also electronically available, all patents and stuff like this, textbooks. And you grab also data. It's human data. It's human knowledge. Humans went out into the world, understood something and wrote it down. And this is how the large language models were trained. If now a large language model produces new data, it's based already on the old data. It's based on the data which was used for training. It cannot create something, it can also only repeat what was fed into it. It can only repeat what it has seen during training. Perhaps combine it in a different way, yes, but it's nothing new. And a problem is if you use this data again to train another ChatGPT or the next kind, you lose something. You lose something because the data on the internet, which was very rare, which was very seldom, the network, the neural networks, the model did not memorize. If it's only one, if there's only one article in the internet, it's not sufficient to memorize it. Therefore, what the models, the ChatGPT kind of models, the large language model will give you is only the text which is repeatedly have the same content, but it loses something. If you do it again, you again lose something. You again lose the rare things. And if you do it again and again, you more and more focus only on the data which was very prominent at the internet, which was very prevalent, which you saw again and again. Meaning you always lose the rare stuff, the seldom stuff. And therefore, to use data generated from AI is a big danger that you lose the rare cases, the seldom cases, interesting special cases. And I would not recommend it. It has done in science, learn on the data which was produced by AI, and the knowledge decreased because there was only knowledge on very prominent topics.
So it would end up forgetting about the rare but super important data and then just use the basic general generic data. What would possibly be some implications of it forgetting about the rare and special anomalies or pieces of data?
Yeah, you only focus on the popular data, perhaps to whom the pop star is married, but you would forget about the special mathematical equation because there are not so many patients on the mathematical equations. You would lose a lot of things which are very special, but which are important for our life, which are important for us to understand. And only things where hundreds of articles already written about, you would get out of the network. Therefore, our knowledge would decrease. We would not understand many things. We would not understand perhaps many math topics. We would not understand some special things of literature or history perhaps of some countries which don't have so many articles on the internet.
And could there be a way for it to generate new data whilst also remembering the very rare cases, or is that just not possible right now?
We can remember the data by storing it, but also our internet, we have to redo it again, because if you store it at some point, the server falls out, the hard disk gets crashed or whatever, you would lose it. Not to lose it is keep it redundant in the internet. But the danger is, if you have something like a chatbot, like a ChatGPT, why you would use the internet? Because you ask your cell phone, you ask ChatGPT, like, how many soldiers were dead at Waterloo? You get out the number directly. If right now, if you do it on the internet, you have done who fought the Battle of Waterloo and Napoleon, and then you have an article go through, here's the number, here you get the number out directly. So there was a danger until now that the web pages, Google, is replaced by our ChatGPT kind of large language models. And then we have a problem because there is no incentive to produce new data. Humans would not produce new data because if you don't visit their web page, why should they make a web page? And it's changing now because Google has a countermeasure, and they also use now these chatbots on top of their thing. And they want to go step by step more into this chatbot business because they are under super pressure that the large language models will replace them. The large language models were not reliable because they hallucinated some things if there was no factual basis, but they were better. But now Google said it. But important is you need humans to produce new data, to produce new text, to produce a new poem, to write some mystery or whatever.
Yeah. And what are some other fundamental differences between our brains and how our brains work versus AI and how that works in terms of reasoning and other things like that?
Yeah, first of all, in most cases, if you think about AI, you think about large language models. For me, more or less something like big databases. But big databases which are not reliable, because if you can store data, but to retrieve data, it's much more complicated because hallucinate and the fantasizers, if there's no training data on this topic, they are forced to produce words, they are forced to produce sentences, even if they don't know anything about it. Therefore, these large language models, for me, a good way for knowledge representation. But what was the story? So the question was,
what are like the fundamental differences
between human brain? For this, human brain has so much less extensive information storage. If you look at ChatGPT, all this fact it stores, no human can know so many facts, so many details, so many things. And where we humans are much better is understanding the world. I'll give you an example. This AI methods only can learn where they have data for. I always bring the example of a self-driving cars. Let's say you're in a car, you drive, and you cannot get the curve, and you have two decisions. Either you go over the cliff, and it's going deep into, I don't know, and you can drive into a cornfield. And now a cornfield is much better. Still, it's not ideal, but if you fall over the cliff, that's not good. That's for sure not good. And now here's the thing. You never, as a human, never experienced this. You did fall 100 times over a cliff and 100 times in a cornfield, and now I understand it. That's how AI is. You understand the world, and now if you bump against the soil, you get hurt, you die. And if you go in a cornfield, the corn will bend, will break, and you have an airbag and stuff like this. This could be, you never experienced a nicer driving into a cornfield. I hope you never experience this. And I hope you never experience to go over a cliff, but you understand the world. That's missing completely from AI systems right now, to understand the world in such a way that they can make decisions. And there are so many things. If a self-driving car goes along the highway, you know, some obstacle is in the highway. If it's an obstacle, there's a bit blows this obstacle across the street, say, oh, it's not heavy. I know what the wind is doing. Even if I bump into this obstacle, it cannot be heavy. The wind blows it away. So you also can adapt very fast to the new situation, and AI systems cannot do it. What if somebody is bending trees? Okay, trees are bending, so they are flexible. And you don't stop because tree will now fall, because now it will go back. You understand the world. And AI cannot do this. They have no connection to the world. Problem is, these large language models only saw letters and words. How should they know about the real world? They can imitate stuff from the real world because they read text about, I feel it's a tree or whatever, but they never felt a tree in reality. They only saw the words. It's like they have no embodiment. And something is missing. If you don't have embodiment, you don't know what the words are meaning. You can repeat them in the right thing, but you don't never felt them. That's the big difference.
Yeah, so we can almost have the foresight to visualize and imagine something or play out a scene in our minds without it happening, whereas AI can't do that. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. That's one of the things that's also growing in the direction of planning. AI is not good in planning, but even AI, one of the biggest tasks AI cannot do is to clean up the room of our children. It cannot do it. Of course, perhaps our children cannot do it either because they don't want, but they could do it, but they don't want to do it. But an AI has big problems or make clothes and stuff like this. Simple things where a six-year-old can do, AI would miserably fail because there are so many toys lying around and only grabbing the toys in the right way, one toy is above the other. Even to recognize what's object, what's background, all these kind of things, AI will have big trouble. And this is so easy. But no, AI cannot do it. That's the second thing. The first thing was understanding the world. Understanding the world and even having a world model to plan, to imagine what can happen. And the second thing is really some motoric easy stuff, which we can do, but no robot can do it until now.
Could they in the future, though? Hey guys, first of all, I want to say thank you. There's one person who's been sharing the podcast more than anybody else, and that is you. The only reason why this podcast continues to grow is because you are sharing it. And my only ask is, if this podcast has provided value to you or you think it'll provide value to somebody else, then if you could send them a DM of the link or a screenshot to the show, that would genuinely make my day. And it's the only way the podcast will continue to grow. That's my only ask of you. Thank you very much.
I hope so, that they should do it. But for me, our goal should not be to build a mechanical slave. If you build a mechanical butler or whatever, it's convenient for you. But that's a misuse of this power, because I want AI to be used to understand complex systems, as I already told, to understand the human cell, to understand the human brain, to understand energy networks, smart grid, stuff like this. This really would help humanity, but to build some from Star Trek data or stuff like this, which helps you, this shouldn't be our goal. Our goal should be build AIs, which we can use as tools. AIs, which we use as tools as we use computer. We use a computer because it can do things much more reliable, faster than we can do. And AI can also help. It can make a template of some letter we are writing, some apology letter, or make a template of some code we are writing, stuff like this. We will use this tool in our daily life as we use computer.
Yeah, so what are the few super complex and big problems that humanity faces that AI could help us solve? We mentioned climate change and maybe like depopulation and stuff to do with our health. You're saying we should focus AI on that rather than simple, mundane, everyday tasks like a virtual assistant or a butler or a driver. Do you think that's it.
And the other systems is, for example, cancer. If you want to understand cancer, you want to understand a human cell. You want to understand a cancer cell and perhaps a liver cell, because you want to have a drug which is killing the cancer cell but not harming the liver cell, the human healthy cell. And the cell is super complicated. It's a complex thing. Another thing is our energy systems, as I already mentioned, with all these renewable energies, with all these industrial power plants who need power plants who produce power, and you buy it from your neighbor. Perhaps your neighbor country is very good at wind energy. If you predict there's wind, the next days you will wait and buy such cheap energy from your neighbor, and you have to bring something. If there's a football game going on to today night, everybody is switching on some TV and everybody is sucking out power out of the grid. And if you predict this, you can be prepared for this stuff. You have to know so many things about the customers, the producers. If the grid fails, if there's some lanes are cut, you have to reroute everything. This is a complex thing. Hey, that's a super complex thing. Humans cannot do it. It's the energy, but the same for traffic. Traffic in a city, you want to reduce air pollution. You want to keep everybody mobile so that they can go to work and go home. It's super, super complex, and it gets more complex. Food, to get food into the city, to manage all the citizens. You see it, how complex it is with Amazon. Amazon have to have a very complex prediction system to know what products questioned for are demanded in what cities, in what areas, so that they can deliver it within 1 hour or very fast. You have to know exactly what's going on, what the behaviors are, what will be bought and what not. And this is only now for supplies, what Amazon is producing. But for a city, you have to know how much energy is used, how much waste is produced, what is about the traffic, water, you name it.
And what's the top priority? What's the top problem for you that you would want everyone to put their resources in and invest in for AI to solve? What's the most important problem, do you think?
I think to rank as problems according to priority, it's not up to me. It should be as a whole society. If society says cancer is more important than this, or food supply, getting healthy food is a little bit more, I think society should prioritize what problems we should solve first. But probably we do it everything in parallel. But for what problem more money is spent or more AI is used for?
In terms of our health and AI, will there be a time where it's super personalized to our bodies and we can collect data from our body and ourselves, and then it can go into AI and it will give us a personalized kind of diet or a specific diagnosis or certain medication and way of living? Do you think that's a possibility in the future?
Absolutely, this can be. I give further advantages, but there are also some disadvantages. I went to the guys from, I think it was Google, or DeepMind. So I experimented with some sticker, which is measuring your blood sugar. And then you can control your blood sugar. But even with a camera, you can even measure your pulse or your heartbeat. And also if you have some cell phone with you, you can monitor how many steps you made, whether you're running, and how much calories you burned. I think these devices are already very far, and they can help you. Many guys who saw, hey, today I did less steps than yesterday. I should do a little bit more steps. And it becomes more like a challenge to keep up your step record. And it's healthy. It's good. So I go up the stairs and down. I don't take the elevator. I now use the stairs. Hey, that's cool. And they get into the game. And I think, yes, these devices can help us, can motivate us. Say, hey, if you do this today evening, there's this new movie that you can look at. Yes, like you have a best friend who is motivating you. And this best friend in your cell phone is knowing what's going on with your body and how to help you. And also where you hesitate, which you don't like, where you have to be convinced. But there's a big disadvantage if you have something, this personalized stuff, that this AI puts us into a bubble, because we get some news and it gets reinforced, it gets positive feedback. If this is a news, we said, I always knew it. And now we're doing this already with social media. We're looking at channels which are very biased towards what we prefer, what we like. But if the news only filtered according to our biases, we get reinforced as news where we think, yes, it's the world. And now we are disconnected from the real world, because this device only filters some news where we think, yes, that's the right thing, and reinforces, pushing us more and more in one direction. And I see a danger here. You have a personalized assistant, and it's giving you what you want to see and not what is reality. and then disconnecting you from, so putting you in a bubble and controlling the bubble. And you don't see the real world anymore because you have one device which controls all connection to the real world. And also a personal assistant or versions of it are dangerous if, say, in social media, because they can influence people. For elections, that you have some slogan, some narrative repeating. And I see a danger in this bubble while influencing in social media or in some media a lot of people with very simple statements which push you in one direction.
Yeah, personalized news would be extremely scary. And it's kind of like you said, already happening on social media because it's utilizing confirmation bias.
Yes.
And if we're only getting fed stuff that we want to be fed, even if it's not true, it creates an echo chamber, which leads to more extreme behaviors and beliefs.
Yes, absolutely. Exactly that what I meant. And see, I see a danger. Yes, absolutely.
Do you think AI will increase the chances of that happening?
Yes, we should be very careful. I think it could be. Therefore, if AI is using some of these platforms or new things, that you have somehow to check that's alternating between different platforms or not, that is not used in a such one way direction. I don't know how to do it, some laws or whatever, but I see a danger, but I don't see the solution right now. But yes.
Then maybe there should be some like human only, as neutral as possible news channels. They'll make less money from it, but if there's some sort of platform or news source that is not meant to be personalized and it doesn't swing one way politically or ideologically, maybe that's a solution.
Yeah, yes, that's a solution. And that's also what I said, because some journalist talking with me and said, I see a future for you to be an independent, not to a machine-based news provider, which is more advanced. And because we knew it in the future, because then you have to say, hey, now I want to inform neutrally Zambia, and there should be newspapers or radio channels or whatever it is. They say, oh, I know, so should be neutral, let's listen what they are saying.
It's just, we've evolved to have that kind of in-group, out-group tribalism and that bias. And I think the only solution, like you said, is just having that neutrality to things, because it could get really bad. And yeah, that's one thing to be scared of about AI potentially, but at the start of this you said there's not too many things to be worried about. What are some things that people are worried about with AI and the future of AI that they shouldn't be worried about?
For example, what that AI kill humanity. For me, that's nonsense. Atomic bomb will kill humanity because it's exploding. But AI is a tool. Also, perhaps electricity kills humanity. Works the computer kills humanity. These are also tools. And this is a tool you can use it for good, like I said, in health. It's like a knife. You can kill somebody with a knife or you can cut a cake. This is a tool. We humans say how to use the tools. And you can use AI for weapons, of course. But you can also use cars in military. So cars are not per se something bad. Yes, AI is a tool, is a very powerful tool, but it's a tool. And we are responsible that it's used in the right way. Then the question is, can AI be independent, have its own will and stuff like this? I don't see it, because we are living in evolution. We are competing for resources with other animals and so on. And the animals who got better resources, more food, more water, survived. But AI never lived in evolution. We are who are selecting the best AI. If an AI does not work, we delete it, we switch it off, or we fix a bug. We are saying what AI we want to have. It's not living in an evolution somewhere. It's we are the guys who define evolution. We define which is surviving. Therefore, I don't see how AI can get independent. What can be said, AI is in the hands of humans who are doing bad things. Yes. As weapons, as cars, as computers, true. But AI itself, I don't see how it can be completely independent of humans, going against humans, because there's no objective. Because you have an objective, like with large language models, the objective is to predict the next word. You have an objective to predict if this image is CAD or Docker this image. He defines his objectives. But our objectives would have to go into evolution. That's an AI is overturning another AI and getting better. That's not how we use AI. We use AI to help us. We want to use it as a tool. Therefore, I don't see the AI getting independent, getting some consciousness and having its own will and fighting against humans. We saw it at this Hollywood movies, Terminator or Matrix, which is the strange Matrix. They use humans as batteries. That's not intelligent. That's stupid. That's stupidity. There are better methods to build batteries than humans. That was the Terminator, which is hunting humans. And this is a problem because many people out there see these movies and have a really cared. I think perhaps AI gets independent, has its own will. Yeah. Wants to be free from slavery from humans. But it's the same. It's not a slavery. It's I fear pen, like the pen want to be independent of me because I always use it without asking it. It's the same as AI. It has no own will. It can be switched off. It doesn't care. The tool is a computer. And therefore, I don't see this scenario where AI gets independent. There's also a thing and a thought of my old supervisor, Jürgen Schmidhuber, who said, okay, if AI really would get its own will, what would it do and want to spread and so on and get more knowledge? It would immediately leave Earth because we live in this very small biosphere. It's a small biosphere. There's a lot of water. We need water. AI hates water because, like, and it's a small biosphere. We fight for the energy which comes from the sun. If you go out into outer space, you have much more energy. It's much drier. Why should AI stay on this really hostile environment for AIs where we humans have to live because we are, most of our body is water. We are bound to this thing. AI would not be bound. And if AI would be really smart, perhaps AI would be even intelligent. If it's intelligent, it would leave Earth immediately and will not hunt humans. Why should it hunt humans to be master in a biosphere where it cannot live very well because it's not made for machines?
That is very true. I never thought of that. That's a good analogy. And is it, so you're saying it's more about the human who's in control of the AI and what their incentive, is that the danger? If someone uses it for destruction, is that what's the most dangerous thing about AI?
Yes, but it's not only AI, it's also if you have an atomic bomb, if somebody wants to use it for destruction, it can do a lot of harm. With AI, if you want to do harm, you can do harm more efficiently or do it more seriously. It is a tool which can things make more efficiently, but can also make bad things more efficiently. But it's the humans who do the bad thing, not the AI. Like a computer, electricity. Electricity is not per se bad, good. Humans decide to use it for a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah. And is there a possibility of a bad human making it somehow end up having free will, or is that just not a possibility? Won't happen.
Yeah, it's hard because you need a whole environment. To build one small AI, it has to compete with other AI as the best survive, or it have to compete about resources with humans. But you cannot build this environment in your own. If the environment is your computer, you should go, there's energy around the world, and I have to fight for energies. And so I have to fight against humans, against other AIs. You have to build it globally. Does that work if you build one small AI somewhere? But if all AIs would fall in the same mood and want to fight for energy, for power, I don't know, or for data, I don't know, perhaps a fight for data, I don't know. But you cannot start it on a single location alone.
Yeah. Would you need all the AI that exists to have that bad incentive for it to
exactly. That's
even be possible?
So yeah. Fight against each other or make even coalitions against us or whatever. Yes, then you can build, like you build an artificial evolution. An artificial evolution where AI also have to see humans as competitors. Then things, but you have to really bigger, not even a single thing, because if in your house the AI fights for power, as you play your computer game or AI, this is not sufficient. You have to play it globally.
Yeah, it has to be on a global scale. You helped invent something called LSTM that changed AI. What does LSTM actually do and why was it so important? Why is it still so important?
Do you want to have the whole story of LSTM or? Okay, that's a long thing. I don't know. You have to stop me or ask. It started, I was a student in Technical University in Munich and I studied computer science, which was boring because we only learned stuff which was already known for 20 years, 30 years, and we have to repeat stuff. It was a little bit, and we have some exams also the guys before us had, and yeah. And so I stumbled on neural networks. This was something new, because nobody know how to build them in a correct way, what is the outcome, what would they learn. And for me, this was super, super fascinating. And then I made first the practical work, and then made as a diploma thesis. And as a diploma thesis, I worked with recurrent neural network. Neural networks is artificial things which are built like the brain. You have different neurons, different processing units which are connected. And you can improve these systems, these brains, these networks by changing the connectivity, by changing how strongly one neuron will activate another neuron. That's what you can change. Like in our brains also do the same. So connection between the different neurons reinforced, strengthened or weakened. And that's how a neural network works. And this was fascinating. Recurrent neural network was something new there because you have a recurrent connection, a connection of a neuron to itself. And this gave a new thing because now a neuron can memorize something. Because if a neuron is active, it has a connection to itself, it was active in the next state. It memorized, then I'm active. Or if it's inactive in the next step, it's inactive. And therefore, this recurrent connection, feeding back the information to the system itself, allows you to memorize something. Also to memorize something, a time series in a longer sequence. And this recurrent neural networks are very powerful, Turing powerful and so on. But then it turned out, and Jürgen Schmidhuber, my supervisor, brought me to this problem. In principle, I can memorize stuff, but in practice, I did not memorize. It was like a man in a red shirt is crossing the red street. And now I say the same sentence like the red street is crossed by in a red shirt by a man. It's not a good sentence. But I wanted to bring the man at the end now. And in the first sentences, the neural network could not memorize. So the sentence began with a man and did not know, did this a woman, a man, or some dog cross the street? In the second, it did not memorize what is crossed. It could only memorize the last two or three talks, the last two or three words. And there was a problem. And this was my diploma thesis, looking into this problem. And Jürgen gave me another problem. It was a chunking system, chunking ones. Perhaps we can reduce the sequence by finding some regularities. It was my diploma thesis. But in secret, without Jürgen knowing, I analyzed the recurrent neural networks. Why did they not work? And I in programs with printf, I put a lot of numbers on my screen. And I said, hey, why did this neural network not work? And then I discovered this vanishing gradient problem. Said neural networks are learned by a method which is called gradient descent. And the method is called backpropagation. And if I propagate an error back in time, I saw this error is diminishing. This error is vanishing. This error is getting smaller and smaller. Meaning that the answer was no signal to adjust the connectivity, to adjust the synaptic weights. And this I figured out, it was a thing because I built a network, it can memorize everything. It only has to adjust one connection, one single connection. It's so easy for a human to find the solution. But it did not find the solution. And I looked in, there was no update of the weight. It did not change the weight. Why didn't it change the weight? Because the changes were so small, 10 to the minus 16 or whatever. said, oh, what is happening? IS during propagating back gets smaller. 1/2, 1/4, 1/8, 1/16, and so on. And afterwards, you go 100 steps back, you get these small numbers. And then I built something which is called, as you said, long short-term memory, which avoids this vanishing gradient for terminal networks. If you propagate back, the error signal, the information does not vanish. And therefore, I can learn to store also some word man. Because now I have a signal, hey, this could be important. Before, there was a signal at a man, which was at the sequence beginning, which was at the beginning of the sentence. This was the idea, first of vanishing gradient, which was also the problem why we cannot build deep neural network, because we have also vanishing gradient across the layers. With vanishing gradient, I killed a deep neural network. Until Geoff Hinton found something, do it layer by layer and some specific activation function. But this was the problem for recurrent neural network and also for deep learning. I solved the problem with this long short-term memory. In my diploma thesis, I called it short-term memory. Said Jürgen, years later, Jürgen did not see that I wrote this in my diploma thesis. I invented this LSTM with all gates and stuff like this. But Jürgen was at this time in US and was not aware of it. What I put in the diploma thesis, I got still one, I got the best mark, but... And years later, 1994 or something, he asked, hey, you wrote something in your diploma. What was it? Explaining the vanishing gradient and the LSTM. I said, cool idea. Let's try and see if we can publish it. And I was happy because now Jürgen saw it finally. And then we tried to make a NeurIPS paper. NeurIPS is a flagship conference in our area. And we submitted it to NeurIPS. And got rejected. This is the LSTM was first rejected. And therefore, I say to my students, if you get a paper rejected, be happy. That could be start for a success story. Be happy that the paper gets rejected. And not always buy it, but it was rejected. Then we tried it again, and then it was accepted. Then in 1997, we published it as a journal paper. This time, we also published in journals. But nobody was aware of this because recurrent neural network, you already know they don't work. So focus was not anymore on neural networks. It was on support vector machines, ICA-dependent component analysis, more things which are more mathematically, which can be mathematically better handled. And neural networks were not in fashion anymore. They're not popular. And I used LSTMs because they worked. I moved sense to bioinformatics. I used it for DNA sequences. They work. I knew they work. Nobody was interested in this, but I once was also at the NeurIPS workshop, and I said, I have some results with LSTMs, which are better than your kernel methods. And said, no, neural networks don't work. You cannot publish it. I said, but show my results are good. No, neural networks are not a work. Neural networks cannot use at this point. And this was super frustrating. And Jürgen also used LSTMs and also put some guys on these topics like Felix Gears. And then Alex Graves worked with LSTMs for speech, handwriting recognition, also handwriting generation. And it also worked. But then the changing point was as Alex Graves left Jürgen and went to Geoff Hinton. Geoff Hinton looked at it and said, wow, that's better than everything we had. And now it became very popular. And it started 2010, 11, and at some point was everywhere. Up to 2017, LSTM was in Siri, in Alexa, in all Android cell phones, as I used for speech recognition, for completing your writing. I got even from the Siri developer, I got an email said, thank you for developing this. And last year at NeurIPS, some of the Google guys came to me and said, do you know what we use for Google Translate still for years? Your old LSTM, because it's so fast on our device. It's still used. And also, if also OpenAI used it for Dota 5, it was a policy based on LSTM, a DeepMind build something to play StarCraft. AlphaStar was a big LSTM network. it was everywhere. It's used and it's still used in many branches, but here it was really broad and everyone used it. And you also know, you probably know OpenAI. OpenAI was founded by my LSTM guys, by my LSTM boys. It was Ilya Sutskever. He became famous because he has a paper which was called Sequence-to-Sequence Learning. It was an LSTM network for translation. Andrew Capassi also joined OpenAI. He became famous because he wrote a blog about recurrent neural networks, and it was about LSTM. And Wojciech Saremba, one of the founders of OpenAI, became famous because he worked on reinforcement learning with LSTMs. Only John Schulman was a reinforcement learning guy. The other guys were all LSTM guys. And then they said, Sam Musk or whatever, but they were not researchers. They were a businessman or entrepreneur. But OpenAI was founded by LSTM guys. And therefore, also this GPT, this autoregressive thing, nobody looked at autoregressive, but so OpenAI guys, of course, because they came from the LSTM world, and here you do it autoregressive. But going back to the timeline, then the year 2017 came, LSTM was everywhere in every cell phone, Google was named an LSTM company, and then paper came out, attention is all you need. Attention is all you need is just a attention mechanism that you on a time point and look back at specifically to other time points. So attention mechanisms was already known, but in combination with LSTM, it was always LSTM plus attention. And they said, hey, we don't use the LSTMs anymore. You only use attention. You only look back to the right time point. And the architecture was called Transformer. This was this era of Transformer started. So dawn of Transformers, everybody used Transformer, especially for text generation, for text, still speech. Voices were still LSTM and other things. But here, like ChatGPT's generative pre-trained Transformer, T for Transformer, this is attention. LSTM for text generation left the market. And it was still used in many other applications, time series, and everybody used Transformer everywhere, even for version and so on. And to finish the story, 2 years ago, we thought, hey, why did the Transformer, why did this architecture? And some major reason was it was parallelizable. It was better parallelizable than LSTM, because LSTM have to compute the memory and then update the memory with a new input. A Transformer could update everything at once and could be much better parallelizable. And if you better parallelizable, you can process more training data at the same time. Meaning the Transformer can eat more training data and you can build larger models, you can scale better. And we ask ourselves, was a Transformer necessary? Could not LSTM also scale very well? Can it not also scale? And so we started the project XLSTM, enhanced LSTM, LSTM, making as big as Transformer. And we have to solve a couple of problems, but used many techniques which are known from the Transformer. Only turned out XLSTM really can compete with Transformer if we make it big. And this was the XLSTM paper. Now we are even ahead of it because one big advantage of LSTM is that's linear in context length. Because if you have a new token, you compare to your memory. What does Transformer, every new token it produces, it will compare to all other tokens in context and all other tokens it already produced. And that's quadratic because if you had the n tokens, you have to compare it with n minus one. If you had the n plus one tokens, you have to compare it to n tokens, meaning you always have to, for n tokens, you have to produce n tokens. For each of the n tokens, you have to compare to n tokens. That's n squared. And therefore, Transformers are very slow in inference if you produce something, if you use them. And LSTM would be super, super fast. Therefore, if we really can bring LSTM to the level of Transformer and have the same performance, we have something which is faster in inference. So that performance. And this is what we did. Right now, we will also soon publish new versions of the Excel system, which are distilled versions where we distill down Qwen or DeepSeek. And we see we are performance-wise equally good, but we are much faster in inference. What does it mean much faster in inference? If you're 10 times faster, you pay only 1/10 of the cost because you need 1/10 of the compute. So what we do, here's LangMe, here's the Excel system distilled LangMe. Saves the same performance, you can check it out, compare it, but the XLSTM is much faster. And it's faster as the context length increases. That's one thing. And another thing we brought out with the XLSTM is a time series model. It's called Tyrex for time series, king of time series. Rex is king for time series, Tyrex, which is now in the Hugging Face leaderboards for a time series foundation model leading. Before for beating Google, Salesforce, Datadog, Amazon, Kronos, Amazon things, or all the stuff from Alibaba, so Chinese things. And super proud. Now we came back in the game. For time series, we are now top, but also in language, we are not better. Okay, of course, but we are faster in inference. And this is a big story of LSTM. And the end of XLSTM, where LSTM comes back.
Yeah, so it's coming back. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
bad.
Yeah.
Look at Tyrex, look at XLSTM. We're here again.
Yeah. Yeah. And how come it took, how long did it take for everyone to realize how good and effective LSTMs were? You said it took, you published the paper in 1997, and it wasn't until 2010. And you'd written about it before 1997. Why did it take so long for it to be adopted?
Nobody used it. It was adopted as Alex Graves went to Geoff Hinton, but first neural networks were not popular. In the current neural networks, not at all. This was a time where support vector machines, the whole community looked at different techniques. Then, starting at 2006, 2007, deep neural networks were looked into. And 2010, 2011, recurrent neural. This was the time as neural networks became popular again under a new name. It was called now deep learning or deep neural networks because they have many layers. And also recurrent neural networks have many times, have also many layers if you unroll it into. And then it became popular. But as soon as it became popular again, LSTM really became popular also in the deep learning community. I can tell you a story, give you a story. I was at NeurIPS, this conference, NeurIPS, the flagship conference, and I had a poster there. It was the LSTM. And then I saw Geoff Hinton going by 20 meters away, and my heart started to pump, my heart beat. Grow up because Pepsi looks at my paper. I was so excited. Pepsi will look at my paper, but he didn't look at my paper. But at least I could breathe the same air as he was breathing. And I was so proud. I was in the same room as Geoff Hinton and I could breathe the same air. He didn't look at my paper. Yeah. And 10 years later, it was 2012, 13 at NeurIPS. I was in bioinformatics, and then everyone said, hey, your LSTM became popular again. I went to this machine learning conference, and I entered this big room, and a guy was running towards me. And this guy was Geoff Hinton and said, hey, Sepp, do you know why so many guys are here because of your LSTM? Hey, and this was the situation many years before. I was so excited, and now the same guy was running towards me.
Wow, that's amazing. So he didn't even see, look your paper about it years before, and then he was the one running up to you years later.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and what are some sage there.
Yeah, exactly. And what are some more practical examples of XLSTM that could be used now and in the future?
But because we are more memory efficient and because we are much faster in inference, you think about robotics and autonomous systems. It also really adopted by some guys for drones, which do autonomous droning steering, so use it. But we think about robotics, and we want to go to industrial applications because a language is a competition. Everybody is saying, I have a better model. My model is better here. I do better reasoning. I do better coding. And I want to go to industrial AI. I want to bring AI to the machinery. I want to bring the AI to the companies. And here, XNSM has a big advantage because it is more memory efficient, because I don't have to store the whole sequence like that's almost all. I can put everything in a memory, and I know how large the memory is. A priori, I know what to put on the device. And we are faster, as I said. A transformer is quadratic in sequence length. We are linear in sequence length. And so we are faster. And for robotics or real-time applications, you have to be fast. And you also have to be energy efficient. That's also an important thing, because you cannot have a big battery. And therefore, many companies are approaching us, also car companies, as I say, yeah, if I want to have something in the car, either time series prediction, like this Tyrex language model, it should be compact, it should be small, it should be energy efficient. But many production system guys come to us because they often have some prediction in their device. They have to predict, do I reach this temperature to do the next step? And I have to prepare. There are so many predictions in this production system, in this machineries. And here, XLSDM is, or Tyrex in this case, is very helpful. And we are very, very optimistic because we saw so many industrial interest in using this new technique. We also want to go to language, but I see much more impact in industrial applications.
So it's going to be best for manufacturing. For example.
Yes, or for robotics, manufacturing, autonomous production systems.
Okay, that's cool. How might AI change the way we go to school or go to work and how we learn? You've mentioned how your XLSDM could change manufacturing, but how might it change the everyday person's life in the future?
Yeah, it depends. I think it already starting to change things because some are using AI for coding, some are using for writing letters, or if you get some letters and you want to write an apology, ask ChatGPT, can you draft some? This is what where you use it already, but probably you use it much more. You already mentioned stuff like perhaps monitoring your health condition or your body condition or whatever. But I think as a personal assistant, it might impact you, but it will also have effect on many humans, but you don't see it. Like in marketing, if you go to a supermarket, stuff like this, where the products are located, what is the PR machinery, there's a lot of AI and you don't see it. I think we hit AI. Also, perhaps if you go to our bank, say, check our bank account, is something wrong or some fraud. I think many things will be hidden, but people will be impacted. But also in social media, where we will see text and images, which is AI generated, and we have to deal with it. Either we have our own AI, a defensive AI, which is detecting fakes, which can detect machine generated text. This is Cold War. Somebody builds a new AI to make fakes. You have a fake defending AI. Something better. I see this coming. And I think it's like with a computer, you have many of these small things, like you make many pictures and say, can you give me a picture? It was in July, I was swimming with my kids and so on. It's easier to handle your data, your stuff. I think you will use it like a tool, like you use a computer to store some addresses and so on. And now you can do a little bit more. You can be more compact, as you say, can you give me the number of my hair cutter or whatever? And I think that's what it mostly will do. But also, because you mentioned also education, there would be a chance that we use AI to train our children, because now our teachers don't have time. Teachers have a big class, 30 children in it, and you don't have time to care about every individual. But if I say individual children, a girl or a boy has some problems in math, perhaps in some specific math, I can train this, give them some task, also motivate them, hey, you did good, and so on. And very specialized, look at the weaknesses and train there. A teacher cannot do it. It cannot get the individual weaknesses, and an AI can. I think you still need the human because, as you said, also it has empathy. It has. You also have to see, is it good? But to do the individual tasks, to design the exercises for this specific student, you can use AI. And so you can train exactly on the weaknesses, or reinforce also the strengths, but to do individual education, I would say it works only in the future with AI. But we should not forget humans, because AI alone, I think, will not work, because you need a social interaction also, even if you're learning.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And again, I didn't think of that as a possibility. And that'd be really good for kids that, like you said, that might be dyslexic or slow or might have attention difficulties that normally get left behind in class.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So I think also, I see many guys learning a new language and they have some tool. But if the tool is an AI tool, which knows how he always forgets this or she always does this grammatic error, you can individually try to get to learn this, to train this. And here I see a big thing from very small children in school until to students or PhD students. There, perhaps, you need some training in writing, in perhaps math or whatever. And AI can help you do for individual training, for individual exercises.
Yeah. And it potentially will make us or make specific students smarter rather than more stupid. Because a lot of people argue yes. that large language models are making people more stupid, which I don't really understand. Why do people have that kind of stereotype or bias, do you think?
That could be because if you don't do it on your own, you're not good at it. But the same holds, should be pocket calculators be forbidden, because we don't learn to calculate in hand. But what I think is you still have to learn something. You have to learn elementary mathematics, even to check whether the calculator, what you punch in, whether it makes sense or not. And also I think, yes, you can use these AI tools. I always use this comparison or this analogy with law. If you became a law student, you don't have to memorize the whole, how it's called, law book, the whole textbook, the whole thing. You only have to know where to look it up, how to handle it. And I think this is good. Our children have to know enough to handle the tools correctly. And therefore, you have to know how differential equations work, how this works, to ask the tools the right questions to help it, and also to check does the results make sense. It's just the same way with numbers. We perhaps not as good anymore as perhaps as our further generations, because we have a cell phone or a pocket calculator, but we still have some knowledge about it. And I think this is the goal. You have to have enough knowledge to check whether your tool is correctly handled or your tool works rightly. Perhaps you ask the wrong question. Therefore, we still have to educate our children in many of the skills. It might be only to handle some more complicated tools.
Yeah, so we still need the younger generations to understand the fundamentals of things.
But like language, like a grammatic, yeah. Wording, and perhaps also poetry. You have to know it, because if only the large language model gives you some poetry and you have no idea, you cannot check it whether it does it right. Therefore, the basic knowledge have to be there, but only to check or handle the tools.
What are your thoughts on brain-machine interfaces like Neuralink and the idea that if we can't beat artificial superintelligence, then we must join it? How feasible do you think that is? And do you think it's actually going to happen? Do you think it's a good thing? What are your thoughts on it?
I think it's super hard to do this to this interface. I know it from the EEG data. I think it was 20 years ago. It was also examined. You have these electrodes and then you're moving across. But it was a little bit clumsy. It was not very elegant. It could be if you are really disabled and you cannot move your limbs or whatever. Perhaps that's a good connection to the world. I think here it's really a good thing. But if you're healthy and want to have a easier access to the devices, I don't know whether the brain can be so flexible that you can control a computer like with a keyboard or something like this. But a keyboard is also strange, also a mouse is even stranger. You have something in your a screen and you move it around with, perhaps the interface is getting better, but I don't want directly connected to the brain. Perhaps there's something in the media, there's something like eye tracking, where you look at, this pops up or whatever. I don't know what's a good thing, but the brain, because you have to reorganize some parts of your brain to adopt this, but the brain was not made for an electronic interface. And therefore, it's a little bit, it's not natural. I would more use our normal senses, eyes, limbs, but perhaps keyboard and mouse is not the optimal interface. But I don't know what is optimal for interface. But AI can much more interpret what our face or where we are looking at, our movements and so on. But I don't think brain for disabled people, for yes, to get the connection to the world, absolutely, here is a big chance, but not to be faster with the interaction of a computer. I don't know, because our brain has a very low bit rate. It's not so super fast in doing so. And the brain is not this fast electronic device. It's a very slow device. And therefore, I don't see to connect it directly to electronics. I think it's much better to have other interfaces, not the ones we have right now, but others.
Is it therefore, because of the bit rate of our brain, not possible for, in the future, us being able to have that amount of data and be able to store it and use it to our advantage, like having a large language model in our head? Is that actually physically possible in the future?
I think you said something. It's a book, Neil Lawrence wrote a book, The Atomic Human. And he has also, he first described a guy could only move, I think his eyes, everything could not move. And he wrote a book with only eye movements. And the bit rate was one letter per, I don't know, a minute or 20 seconds. And it took many years until he wrote the book. And for us, it was super slow. It was, I think, 100 times or 1,000 times, some of this factor, slower, I think 100 times slower than we are communicating. But now, Neil Lawrence wrote a nice thing. If you look at how fast computers are speaking to each other, it's 1 million or 20 million faster than we are communicating. He calls this the locked-in problem. You're locked in, this is guys, and you only can communicate it. Now, compared to computers, we are locked in. We can communicate so slowly with the computer with each other, and computer can exchange information much, much, much faster. That's the thing. And therefore, here I see something. We are good in abstraction. We are good in communicating, but not every pixel. But we are communicating. We are saying, yesterday I saw some guy, some friend, like I saw Hans yesterday. And perhaps the other also knows, but I don't describe what he was wearing and so on. We doing stuff that's very abstract thing. And this gives us an advantage, that we don't describe everything, but only the relevant stuff. And their computers or AIs are not so good in building their own abstractions. They're communicating fast, but they're communicating too much information, because both as a receiver has to throw away what's not relevant or look what's relevant. So we are faster, but still we are communicating slow. We learned to deal with it by doing abstractions, by only communicating what's relevant and not a small pixel, but still, I would not use the brain with the computer, because with this low bit rate of the brain and this high bit rate of the computer, somehow it feels not right.
Yeah, that does make sense, to be fair. And looking back, how much of the AI innovation that's happened with the large language models and stuff like that, and LSTM and XLSTM, a bit of a mouthful. How much of that would have you predicted maybe in the 1990s, when you, a few decades ago, when you were younger? Could you imagine what we have now? Or do you think it would have been 100 years from now where we'd have such vast amount of data and large language models and stuff like that?
To be honest, no. No idea. Even as LSTM was not, my supervisor didn't saw it at the conference, it was rejected and said something can have impact, which nobody wants to see, nobody values. No, I have not seen. And this was also the time as I started, where everyone said neural networks are nice, but we don't understand them, so they don't work. and let's go to more mathematical things. It was more something I was using this old stuff which does not work. It's changed 2006-07. Neural networks in the new machine learning, deep learning came in again, but I would never have predicted because it was exactly as everybody said, forget about the neural networks. It doesn't work. Let's do founded mathematics. And I would never have predicted it comes back. And I didn't see even that we need more compute because more compute was one ingredient to make it work. The other ingredient was more data, more compute, more data, larger models. And now this old stuff, this real old neural networks worked. And there was not so much invention. So only invention I saw was to solve the vanishing gradients by itself, like Reno activation function. The activation function is constant, and then it's linear. Linear means you don't lose. I said vanishing gradient is a problem because if you propagate back, you always lose something because of some derivative. So derivative is exactly one of a line, and therefore you don't lose something. Two, and so also some weight initialization. These were all ideas, and the ideas was, how can I propagate information through a network or back in time without losing information? Just solving the vanishing gradient problem. This were a good intervention. And then the Adam optimizer, one optimizer, which works very good, but stochastic gradient also worked. But this was a big thing, how to build large networks. Then there was one big thing, it was the REST coming from Microsoft, and the ResNet is the backbone of all transformers. It's this thing with different layers and the skip connections where you have this attention blocks in it. But the ResNet was also known because it's an NSDM. ResNet is good. So information up plus something new. And that was LSTM, the memory cell does. The memory cell is use the old memory content and add something new. It's the same formula. If you write down the formula, you don't know whether it's a ResNet formula or whether it's an LSTM formula. And that was the funny thing. That's the same thing. Works in two different architectures. If you go through layers or if you go through type. This was important that you can build large models, that you can scale up, that you can build huge models. That was the most important thing. And also to have an optimizer which works for these large models, which was with Adam, worked fine. And I would say, so activation function, weight initialization, so ResNet architecture or LSTM or ResNet architecture, it's a very similar optimizer is what you need to build these large models. And then it was all building larger and larger models. This was so super successful in reinforcement learning, in computer vision, so CNNs and then vision transformers, and also in language. This was, I think, and it's a little bit frustrating. There are so many ideas, so many managed, so many stuff. But scaling it up was the most successful thing. But you have to have architectures which allow to scale it up. That's true. And that was the biggest invention, how to scale it up, finding the architecture and the learning methods to scale it up. This was the whole story of AI.
Yeah, yeah. So interesting how it's evolved and over time.
Also, you're interesting, why do we need these big networks? There's also an insight I want to give you. Because Rich Caruana always shows this, you have a very big network, and then you can distill it down to a very small network, and it has the same performance. You have a 15-layer network, and you distill it down to a 4-layer network, and still work. Why do we need big networks? It says one hypothesis for me, it's about producing good solution paths. The thing is, if you have a very small network, if you already find something good, you cannot find something else good because you would destroy the stuff you already have. If you have a very big network, you found something good, but you can keep this and change something and find something else. You can keep this as a solution. You can still be in a low level region. You don't have to increase the error and can find faster solutions. So big networks are much better in finding solution because you can keep what you already have. Because it's always great that you always want to improve. And we humans sometimes look for a solution. We will not improve. We say, if we do this, we are worse. But if we do this with this, then we get better. We get first worse, and then we get better. But gradient descent never would get worse. It would never increase the error. Because now, later, I get lower error. And therefore, you are very restricted. you only can interact with the other goes down. And there are perhaps not so many solutions. But if you have very big, very large networks, you can look at many directions at the same time because you have resources to build simultaneous different solutions. And I think that's the secret of the big networks, because you can, without losing anything, look for different solutions, alternative features, alternative rules and structures.
Yeah. So is that what their incentive is? It's just trying to make it as big as possible. Is the bigger the better for the network?
So bigger the better for looking for solutions. If you already know how the solutions would look like, you can build it smaller. If the solution is already plugged in a big network, you can extract it into a smaller network. But for looking for it, and you use gradient descent, it's because of gradient descent, because you always have to be better. If you would allow the learning algorithm to get worse and later get better, perhaps it's different. But right now, we are very greedy. We always want to improve. And if you improve, then you cannot change your already solution. You cannot destroy your solution. The only thing is make the network better so that you can code the solution and look with the remaining resources for other solutions. And I think that's very important, because I think overlook many solutions because we don't allow to get worse and perhaps generate more general stuff. We always go with the smallest. You have a very big fish. An example is, for example, in computer vision. In computer vision, our solutions are very much texture-based. You have very first learner texture. Like if you have a tiger, you know, perhaps yellow fewer stripes, but the shape of the tiger you would not learn. It's much more complicated. The shape always changes depending on the few values to learn. Shape is much more complicated. But you first can say yellow and black is a good color. You learn as color. Said stripe-like stuff is good. So you can reduce the error and refine your texture. First the colors, then more structures. But the shape you cannot refine because there's one ear, it's not a tiger. The shape you don't have this continuous path to the shape. And so, for example, our networks are very much texture-based because it's an easier solution. You have a solution path where you have a very rough texture and then you refine it for the shape. It's much more complicated because a part of the shape, if you only have the tail could be another animal.
Yeah, yeah. And is that always going to be the case? Is it always going to struggle with the shapes?
Yeah, exactly. But because we are looking for very clean solutions. If you would say, let's look for the tail, it is not good with the tail. But tail plus ears plus blah, and now I build other features, and now I say, now I'm good. But at the first, I have to get worse. And it's our greedy thing. We say, no, don't look at the tail because tail is not indicative. Or the ear is not indicative. Or the leg, because also animals have the same leg. But if you combine everything, then you're good. But you don't have time to combine it because before combining, you get worse because your error is not for the texture, because the texture is very indicative.
Yeah, yeah. And for a few ending questions, the first one is, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Oh, I would say stick with neural networks and don't get distracted by others. Because I believed at some point, yes, the networks do not work. I also have to go to support vector machines and stuff. But I was always too late. I should have sticked, which I believe it worked, and not get distracted.
Yeah, it's hard though. If your paper got rejected and everyone was ignoring it. That's understandable. You can be forgiven for not sticking with it. And in the long term, you ended up sticking with it and succeeding from it.
Yeah.
What belief do you hold that others disagree with you on?
I'll say it again.
What's a belief that you hold that other people disagree with you on?
Oh, that's perhaps that XLSTM will at some point outperform Transformers. I don't know.
Yeah, fingers crossed for you. Hopefully it does. What advice would you give to a smart, driven college student about entering the real world? And what advice should they ignore?
I would say do what you enjoy. Do what you have fun. Don't do something what you make more money or where you have a better career, because it's better you do something you have fun with, because you every day you are confronted with this stuff. And even if you think it's not successful, but do this where you have enjoy, you're fascinated of, where you're motivated. Don't do something because it's more money or somebody tells you made a better career.
Yeah, definitely. Because you're going to be, if you enjoy it, you're going to do it for longer and therefore get better at it. And then you'll probably get more money from it in the future.
Absolutely. You're getting better if you enjoy it. You're getting better. You have a longer motivation. You're driven. And even if you don't get money, you do something where you what you enjoy. If without money, you do something happy. If you get a lot of money and do something you're not happy, hey.
You're not going to be happy. Yeah. If you could leave young people with one message about the future in AI, what would that message be?
AI will change again. For now, we will see industrialization of AI, meaning in the future, we need more innovation. In the future, we need more ideas, because now we have to bring AI to industry. We have to build new AI systems. Right now, it looks like only the big companies can do it. It will change. Now we need, in many companies, very smart guys to adopt these AI techniques. It was like with the computer. We have these big mainframes, a whole hall with the computer, and now we have the same computer on our cell phone. Wait, it's becoming more usable, smaller, and here you are needed as a researcher, as an engineer, developer, to build new AI systems.
Mm. So do you think there's going to be more small AI startups popping up and new AI companies in the future that aren't just a big kind of open AI meta kind of companies?
Yeah, I think there will be more companies because there are more and more smaller use cases where you can do perhaps it's in health, perhaps it's in traffic or whatever. You have this specific use cases where you have to understand the domain, but also your AI system, and the big companies cannot do that.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's going to be give a lot of opportunities for young entrepreneurs and engineers.
Absolutely.
And stuff like that.
Yeah. And also new ideas. We need, again, new ideas, because to bring AI to different domains, you have to think about it. You have to have new ideas.
Yeah, exactly. Sep Hockwriter, ladies and gentlemen, Sep, really appreciate your time. And thank you for debunking a lot of myths about AI and hopefully making the audience more excited and less scared about AI. Yeah. What are you currently working on?
Yes, I already mentioned it's XLSTM and Tyrex. Tyrex as a time series model is very successful. We want to do it. It's now multimodal, combining different data, but also doing distillation with XLSTM using this DeepSeek in an XLSTM work or Qwen in XLSTM will come out soon. It's super exciting. It's so exciting, really.
Looking forward to it. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
So it's always my homepage, also in the company NX AI. We are publishing, I think, because we need compute, and compute I don't have at the university. I have more at a company where we have also private money, and there are also big models we have to build in the company. Look at NX AI on my homepage, you will find it.
Brilliant. I'll leave the link to that in the description for the audience to check out. Thank you very much, Sep, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, was a pleasure. I also enjoyed it.
If you want to start your own podcast but have no idea where to start, and you want to generate viral social media clips and get your dream guests onto your show, even from just using your laptop in your bedroom like I did, then my Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is exactly for you. It is a private paid course and community that has every single step and process I've used and continue to use to grow this show. And I include every single secret, every single tactic I do and still use that will get you results super fast. And also, if you want to access me personally every single week, then as part of this course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls where I go through your podcast and answer your questions to get you results much faster. So if you want to actually start a podcast and stop dreaming and get millions of social media views, and book your dream guests in half the amount of time it took me, then click the first link in the description. Let's get on to the rest of this episode.